We are suffering from unbearable conditions and the Israeli strikes.
The family of Dima Masleh was among those lucky families who could find a place in the surrounding areas of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital. 10 members, including the parents, their children, and a paralyzed aunt, are crammed in a small tent that provides no cover or protection from rain or the freezing cold weather. It's needless to mention their daily struggle to find food to eat or water to drink.
Actually, I'm a refugee here in El Deir camp. Now, as you see, I'm in a tent with 9 families. You know how much in 9 families there's like more than 10 people in every family. And we live like literally with simple materials to live. Like there is no covers, there is no supplies like water, like anything like food or covers. Actually, no one do anything here. They just stare about us and they don't do anything.
Dima is a 21-year-old Palestinian girl. She studies translation in the Al-Azhar University in Gaza, which is now reduced to rubble over the relentless Israeli airstrikes. Like all Gaza students, Dima has her own dreams of completing her college, having a good job, and live a peaceful life in her house. However, the Israeli occupation forces ruined all her dreams, as the vast part of Gaza Strip is transformed into a livable place.
I was in my home. I was just preparing for the college in the morning. Then everything, this war happened. There is no warning. We just run from our home and we go to the school. They say, okay, the UN school is safe. I just wanted to give this message to the whole world. We need to stop this war. We don't need supplies like water and food. Okay, right, we need it, but we need to stop this war. Like, I lost my home. I don't know where I will back.
Dima is another example of the Palestinian student whose life, future, and dreams were ruined by the Israeli regime that has been bombarding the besieged strip for roughly 3 months in a row. This sort of the barbaric bombardment against the besieged strip goes beyond any description in terms of a brutality against civilians. Mota Abu Msabih, the central area of Gaza Strip.
A unifying figure, no doubt, a role model and a symbol of hope, self-confidence and courage. On his fourth martyrdom anniversary, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani is a source of inspiration more than ever. The reason why Tehran University has decided to recognize and reward prominent figures with outstanding works focused on the top commander himself and his way of life as freedom seekers worldwide and in particular resistance fighters in Gaza continue to look up to him and follow in his footsteps.
Today, the occupying Israeli regime and the Americans who were talking about destroying Hamas are sending messages and indirectly negotiating with Hamas about how to manage Gaza after the war and how to exchange prisoners. This all means that the axis of resistance has won this war, and once again resistance has paid off, the resistance that Martyr Qasem Soleimani stood up for.
Martyr Soleimani is not just a person. Martyr Soleimani is a school of thought. It's important for us to see the world through his eyes and follow in his footsteps. That is why I've published a book including my research on Martyr Soleimani's leadership style that can be used as a reference for our future leaders. I believe we need more people using his methods and leadership for us to be successful.
The 20 laureates were picked out of a short list of 150 prominent figures who have made great efforts to shed light on the different aspects of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, both as a person and as a hero and the top commander that he was.
Haj Qasem Soleimani is one of the most influential people of our time. In Palestine, and particularly in Gaza, we owe our resistance to him. That is why we call him the Martyr of Al-Quds. Young boys and girls in Gaza see him as a role model.
Martyr Soleimani is one of the greatest people in history, a unique person and a true hero. I think he is a great role model for our younger generation, and it's our duty to pass on his teachings to them.
He's very much loved by people all over the world, not just in Iran, but internationally. He's a symbol of resistance against imperialism, against hegemony, against arrogance, against the occupation, against apartheid, against genocide. And he continues to fulfill that role years after he was assassinated by the criminal American regime.
In West Asia, many people who are fighting for freedom against global imperialism see their path to victory through his teachings and his way of life. And Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani will continue to be a symbol of resistance for generations to come. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
In a poignant display of solidarity, Christians residing in Pakistan have opted to hold traditional Christmas celebrations with simplicity due to Israel's ongoing onslaught in Gaza. Their decision is a symbolic gesture of empathy and concern for relentless challenges faced by the people of Gaza during this festive season.
The message of Jesus Christ was the message of peace and security. We deceased in Palestine. On this Christmas, our hearts are heavy, and we feel compelled to express our brothers and sisters in Gaza.
Pastors from various Christian communities across Pakistan gathered in the capital city, Islamabad, on Sunday for a special joint prayer meeting to appeal for a ceasefire in Gaza.
In the spirit of Christmas, we gather here to raise our voices in prayer for the innocent lives affected by the conflict in Gaza. Our prayers are with the people of Palestine, and we stand united in our plea for a ceasefire and lasting peace.
Meanwhile, a diverse gathering of people also expressed solidarity with the oppressed people of Gaza through the display of vibrant balloons, each carefully adorned with messages of solidarity and support.
The situation of Gaza is extremely distressing. It is genocide, it is violence, and it is extreme power play in a region that does not deserve this at all.
Cease fire now!
Demanding an immediate ceasefire, the individuals of all ages called on the world to halt the ongoing genocide of Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip.
Christians in Pakistan are using this Christmas to advocate for peace in Gaza rather than engaging in traditional celebrations. The gesture underscores that humanity is not confined by religious or national boundaries, but it is all about showing compassion for the people in distress. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
For the 11th weekend in a row since the start of Israel's most brutal war on Gaza, rallies were held in Sydney and Melbourne in support of Palestinians. In Sydney, thousands of people gathered once again in Central Business District's Hyde Park for a rally dubbed Stop the Genocide in Gaza, called by the Palestine Action Group, an activist formation committed to supporting Palestine and opposing Israel apartheid. A number of other groups also joined the rally, calling on Western governments to finally put some pressure on Israel for its ongoing violence, genocide and oppression against Palestinians.
I think the Australian government continues to be a firm backer of Israel, to their great shame. So clearly, again, 11 weeks of massive protests, the likes of which we've never seen before, is having an impact, and they're feeling the pressure, so they're shifting their rhetoric a bit.
The rally, attended by school union representatives, was also joined by a group of outraged Sydney-based Jews who hold anti-Zionist views.
So-called posture of the Western countries and so-called international law is, in my opinion, just pointless, and it's appalling. But quite frankly, we've got a genocide happening right in front of us.
Some of the speakers acknowledged that Palestinians are experiencing the same struggle as the indigenous people in Australia. Many hundreds of thousands of Aboriginals have been killed or forcibly removed from their land and their families at the hands of colonial authorities over the past 200 years.
People at the Sydney rally praised South Africa for filing a case against Israel at the International Court of Justice, accusing Tel Aviv of committing genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. More than 21,500 civilians have been killed by the Israeli army so far, including nearly 9,000 children and 6,500 women.
I mean, it is genocide. They should go to the International Criminal Court because they are committing war crimes. War crimes many, many times over. I mean, it's obvious, you know, this is the obvious to ordinary people that this is a massive ongoing war crime.
Also on Saturday, a rally in solidarity with the Gazans was held at Melbourne's State Library for the 11th week in a row. Max Civili, Sydney.
In response to the call of the Free Palestine movement, massive crowds gathered in the Yarmouk refugee camp near Damascus to show their confidence in the strength and determination of the resistance in Gaza, confirming that the Al-Aqsa Flood operation is a fateful battle that ignited hope in their hearts, as it brings them closer to the defeat of the Israeli occupation and their return to their homeland.
We are here to support people in the Gaza Strip and voice our unconditional support to the resistance groups. After nearly 3 months of fighting, it's clear that the Zionist regime is facing defeat. The Al-Aqsa Flood operation revealed that Israel's collapse is imminent.
The Israeli occupation politically has nothing now, military has nothing now, security has nothing, economy has nothing, and we also tell the world that October 7th is the gate for the liberation of the whole Palestine, from the river to the sea.
Participants confirmed that the excess of resistance embraces the Palestinian struggle and supports all resistance factions, including the Al-Qassam Brigades and Al-Quds Brigades. They expressed their anger at the Israeli atrocities against the people of Gaza, emphasizing their adherence to their right of return and liberating Al-Quds.
Syrians and Palestinians have shown their absolute faith in the victory of the Resistance Front and Al-Aqsa Front operation, not only as a path to liberate the occupied lands, but also as inspiration for the generations to come. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee. and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O, the Most Merciful.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
To the debate. I'm Kavit Atwai. In Iran, people have marked the fourth assassination anniversary of the anti-terror commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. And while this honorable event was taking place, a horrible terrorist incident has occurred here in the Islamic Republic, claiming the lives of many Iranians who are paying homage to him. Why did this terrorist incident take place at this time? Was it, to use Iran's interior minister's words, to detract Iranians' love and honor for the anti-terror icon, Qasem Soleimani? Also, in terms of this incident, terrorist incident, was it to use a means to detract from the way that Iranians were paying respect to him? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the legacy of this prominent figure in Iran's history, which revitalized the axis of resistance in the region, a basis for the courageous fight the resistance fighters are waging against the Israeli regime forces in the Gaza Strip. And this is while Iran's president has said that the resistance groups will make Israel pay a heavy price for its terrorist act. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Syed Mohammed Marandi, university professor and political analyst, joins us from Tehran. Also joining us is Syed Mostafa Khoshesh, political analyst from Tehran. Welcome to you both. My condolences obviously go out on this sad occasion that was meant to honor the late Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, but obviously an analysis needs to be put into the picture, and if you could put things into context for us. First, I think it's worth remembering, and I'll start with you, Syed Mohammed Marandi, the reasoning that was given back when the targeted assassination took place by the U.S. on Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, the former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo saying that there was imminent attacks that he had planned. Which we understand, obviously, is a false premise. Maybe you can recount to us why that type of thinking went into play as the basis for what was said at the time was the assassination of Haj Qasem Soleimani.
Well, if an imminent attack was about to take place, the last place where he would be in Baghdad. Obviously, that's nonsense. And we also recall that the Iraqi prime minister at that time he said very specifically that General Soleimani came to Iraq to visit me because he had received a letter from the Saudi Crown Prince and they wanted to discuss rapprochement. So after midnight, General Soleimani, when he arrived in Baghdad from Damascus, he was leaving the airport with his colleagues and with Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, who was leading the fight against ISIS in Iraq, the Iraqi commander. And he was to meet the prime minister at 8 a.m., if I'm not mistaken, in the morning, hours later. And that's when the Americans killed him. And obviously, the Americans had information about the intention of General Soleimani to meet the prime minister and to discuss the peace and rapprochement with Saudi Arabia, because the Americans are everywhere in Iraq. And therefore, that's all nonsense. The Americans wanted revenge because they had been humiliated by the resistance, whether in Syria, where the Americans had supported extremist groups, they had supported ISIS, they had supported Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda. One example is the email from February the 12th, 2012, from Jake Sullivan to Hillary Clinton, who was the Secretary of State at that time, and Jake Sullivan, who is now the National Security Advisor of Biden. In that email, and you can, everyone can find this online, he said, Al-Qaeda is on our side in Syria. This is in early 2012. And we know that later on, ISIS, which was a part of Al-Qaeda, broke away from Al-Qaeda. So they were supporting these extremist groups. The defeat of ISIS, the defeat of Al-Qaeda, was something that angered the United States. It angered Trump, both their defeat in Syria and Iraq, and the Americans were angry that it created a bond, a strong bond between the Iranian people and the Iraqi people, and they got their revenge. But in my opinion, the Americans miscalculated, because it mobilized the Iranian nation. Millions of people came to the streets to commemorate, in Tehran alone, to commemorate the martyrdom of General Soleimani.
Now, this is a point that I'd like to take up with you, Sayyid Mustafa Khoshesh. The fact that you have, I believe one of our guests actually said this, which I'm going to ask you, that this terrorist incident that has now taken place in the Islamic Republic, he said that the U.S. and Israel actually fear Haj Qasem Soleimani's death even more now that he's dead than alive, because the legacy that he left behind and what he stood for in terms of the anti-terror icon is an inspiration for example, resistance groups to continue this fight that they're having in terms of the imperialist powers like the U.S. And therefore, that aspect of it is what stands out right now. Do you think that that is a valid perspective and what this represents in this case?
Hello, and thanks for having me, and hello to Dr. Marandi. Well, that's true, actually. Qasem Soleimani was a unique commander. When he, before he they martyred him, he had already told friends in Quds Force as well as in Lebanon that he had planned the future of the resistance against the Americans and Israelis for the next years to come. And that's true. It's no secret. Everyone knows that General Soleimani, you know, provided logistical backup and everything to the resistance groups, including Hamas and others all across the region. And I do believe not much, but all of the things that we see these days is the product of Qasem Soleimani, and he is even more frightening to the Americans and Israelis these days, even more than before. The kind of strategy that he started over 20 years ago, some 20-something years ago, still continues. Let's remember that back in 2001, the United States invaded Afghanistan. Later, after a couple of years, they invaded Iraq, and they were on both sides of Iran. 38 original U.S. bases, they all encircled Iran, threatening Iran. And it was then that Qasem Soleimani started his mobilization paradigm or formula based on what we had already experienced during the war, Iraqi imposed war on Iran in the 1980s. And then he embraced success everywhere that he went after this paradigm and formula in Afghanistan, Iraq, and all across the region. Now, after 20 years, where are the Americans? On those days, they were encircling us, and we were inside the borders. Now, our influence and regional might and power has admittedly expanded to the Mediterranean. But where are the Americans? They have been fading away in this region. Now, they have threatened even one of the Iranian allies, Hezbollah, to step back from engaging in the war, in the Israeli war against Gaza. But they stayed unintimidated, and they, started attacks on Israel. They also sent their warships to the Red Sea to threaten the Yemeni nation. Sure. And Yemen's army. But they failed, and as you can see, Yemen continues attacks on Israeli-bound ships, and they have stayed undeterred. So as you can see, these are the products, these groups and allies, they are the products of the efforts made by Haji Qasem Soleimani, the respectable martyr, and martyr general. And also, in response to your question, we could still see Haji Qasem Soleimani on the scene pretty well and very much clearly.
Okay. Let's look at what has occurred today in terms of the terrorist incidents, Mohamed Marandi. If we were to take a look at the three incidents that have taken place, Said Razi Mousavi, the Iranian military advisor in Syria, and then you have what happened in Beirut in terms of senior Hamas leader Salah Arouri, and then you have what's happened today in the Islamic Republic. Why do you think this occurred? Of course, no matter who has analyzed this as pointing the finger at Israel being behind it, but what do you think in terms of the timing of it today and after these two targeted assassinations?
The fact that this terror attack today occurred immediately after the terror attack in Beirut and the terror attack in Damascus before it makes people think that it was probably the Israelis that carried out this operation, either alone or with an ally like ISIS, because the Israelis and ISIS cooperated in the dirty war in Syria. ISIS was, they had bases alongside the Golan Heights for years. Their injured militants were treated in Israeli hospitals. Whenever the Syrian army would try to attack ISIS, Israeli Air Force and artillery would support ISIS. So there is a strong relationship between the two. They tried to bring down the Syrian government along with NATO regimes and regional allies of NATO to break the resistance and create a gap between Iran and its friends in Gaza, the West Bank, and Lebanon. And they failed. So it is quite possible that the Israeli regime was behind this. And the reason, obviously, would be that the Israelis are angry. They've lost the war in Gaza. They've lost the military war in Gaza. They've lost the intelligence war in Gaza. And they've destroyed their credibility across the world. And they've destroyed the credibility of the collective West through this genocide, through this Holocaust. So this has been a catastrophic defeat for the regime. So they are angry. But on the other hand, Netanyahu wants to expand the war, because if the war, and he wants to continue the war, because if the war ends, he will be put on trial and he will probably go to jail. So the longer the war, the better it is for Netanyahu. The longer the genocide continues, the better it is for Netanyahu's allies as well. So he has an incentive to continue the war and also to spread the war, because he's losing. And that is how he can he hopes that the Americans could be brought into the battlefield, which I think is obviously very detrimental to the interests of the United States, because this is not Libya. We're not talking about Iraq, a broken Iraq under Saddam Hussein, a sanctioned Iraq. We're talking about a network of resistance that goes from the Red Sea to the Mediterranean to the Hindu Kush. It is an enormous alliance the resistance block mm-hmm. or the resistance axis. And if there's confrontation, obviously, with Iran, it's not a battle that the Americans can win because Iran could destroy all the facilities in the Persian Gulf. Those countries, if the Americans attack Iran, all those countries that have military bases, American military bases, would be hostile, would be considered as hostile. So their oil and gas installations would be fair game. And in addition to that, that would create a global economic meltdown.
Sure.
And that would be an enormous loss to the United States. So I don't think that the Americans, I have no doubt that the Americans don't want the war to expand. Okay. But Netanyahu has a vested interest in expanding the conflict.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Since you mentioned the vast area that the resistance groups cover, I think it's only appropriate that I ask you, Mostafa Khoshesh, about what Iran's leader has said. And maybe you can expand on this further for us, how Haj Qasem Soleimani was instrumental in reviving the resistance front in the region, in the areas that our guests there just mentioned. How was he able to do that?
As I said earlier, when Americans attacked Afghanistan and Iraq, the resistance actually moved to a second stage when, Qasem Soleimani started mobilizing groups and all across the region, especially in a region when we were under threat by the United States, actually, and the other Muslim nations were also under threat. They were being threatened. They were invaded by the United States, and it was clear that the U.S. wanted to, push seven countries all across the region into chaos in compliance with its greater Middle East plan. So this mobilization that was, modeled on Iran's mobilization during the Iraqi and post-war, started and it expanded, and it could, wreak havoc on Americans everywhere. Now, it's doing the same to the Israelis and Americans everywhere, and as Dr. Marandi said, they know the dire costs of any kind of hostile action against Iran. They realize it's in Washington. Although Netanyahu is very much desperate to keep himself in power because he knows the aftermaths if the war goes on and without expansion, even if we don't see a ceasefire, many believe now that in about 4 or 5 months, even if the Gaza war continues, Netanyahu will be, brought down from power, and that would be the end of his career. Not just that, but also he will be put behind bars because of his corruption cases and his failure. Uh-huh. His greatest sin, not his sin, but guilt and flaw of the Israeli army and security apparatus, as well as Netanyahu's, guilt and shortcoming, is that the Israeli defense doctrine was shattered in the first 6 hours that Hamas went on attacking them, and they lost all the principles of their military doctrine, and they found themselves surprised and shattered. So these are all the products, what Hamas did. what Hezbollah is doing, what Yemen's army is doing. These are all the products of the model of the move that was started by Martin Soleimani and his efforts and paradigm.
Okay, so still trying to figure out the reasoning that is given when it comes to the genocidal war itself, Mohammed Amari. Are we looking at Israel seeing this as an existential threat if they don't succeed there in the Gaza Strip? Or is it because they're losing there, they realize it, and therefore they are trying to open up the war in different fronts, like I mentioned about the assassination of Saleh al-Aruri, the Sunni Hamas leader, and Sayyid Razi Mousavi, and of course now what has happened to the Islamic Republic?
I think there are two layers here. One is sheer anger and emotions. The Israelis are very upset, very angry. They're openly talking about genocide, and they're repeating it day after day. You see MPs speaking about genocide, major military commanders speaking about genocide, government ministers. The Israeli president spoke of genocide, the prime minister, Netanyahu, the defense minister. This is the genocidal intent is usually something that even the most evil of regimes hide from the international community. But in the case of Israel, out of sheer despair and anger, they've been saying it day after day. And this is highly detrimental because they're admitting to the world what they're doing. And they are extremely angry towards the Iranians because the capabilities of Hamas in Gaza, the tunnels, what Hamas and its allies, the Islamic Jihad and others have been able to help them defeat the Israeli regime. So there is an emotional component to this in their terror attacks, whether it's against Hamas officials in Lebanon or the Iranian general in Syria, or potentially, that if the Israelis were indeed behind it, the terror attack in Kerman. The second layer is, as you pointed out, the Israelis have lost the war. And this, the aura of Israeli invincibility is gone. It took its first blow in 2000 when it retreated from Lebanon. Then the defeat in 2006 was a second blow. But this was a decisive blow, especially since Ansarullah, the Yemeni armed forces, blocked Israeli ports in the south. Hezbollah drew half of its army to the north, and Hamas and its allies were hammering the Israeli armed forces in Gaza. And the Israeli regime, out of sheer anger and racism and rage, was constantly massacring ordinary people. So Israel has destroyed its credibility across the globe. It's shown itself to be genocidal, both in language and words, but also in action.
Sure.
So the Israelis are in a very bad situation. They're in a very painful and difficult situation. And they need, or at least Netanyahu, both for his selfish interests, as Mr. Khoshkhish rightly pointed out, but also they need the Americans to come in to save the day. And that is not going to help the Israelis. And this proves that the Israeli regime, not only is it detrimental to the interests of the West, its very existence, but also it shows that the Israeli regime is willing to sacrifice its Western allies for its own selfish interests.
That's the key question here then. So what do you think, Mostafa Khoshkhish? When is that red line going to be crossed? We're looking at three different incidents now, almost back to back. If Israel is to continue down this path, are we looking at a massive retaliation? What are we looking at? All the resistance fronts? Some? Iran to be included or not? How do you see this? Were Israel to continue down the path that it is?
How much time are you going to give me about that?
Well, just keep it short. I'm sorry. We're almost reaching the end of the program.
Okay. So let me put it in a nutshell. Okay. First of all, let me add something to my earlier response that General Soleimani, when he did this mobilization program and planning for the Muslim world, for the oppressed Muslim nations, he had, a very good principle that he established. We in Iran, we never look at these allies as proxy forces. That's our difference with others, with the Americans and Israelis, because they use them as, some proxy forces, some terrorists that they hire. But we in Iran look at these groups, as well as the states like Iraq and Syria, as our allies. The difference comes in this, that we do not try to feed them with fish, but we teach them to catch fish. This is a difference, different, because we look at them as allies, equal allies on equal footing. Now, in response to your questions, definitely I agree with Dr. Marandi that this is, somehow masterminded by Israel or conducted by Israel. This could have been Israel, or this could have been some terrorist group like Jaish al-Zul, Jaish al-Adl, or ISIS, who have been the plot has been masterminded and done by the Israelis. Definitely, there is no doubt about that. And I do agree that Netanyahu, because of his failures in this war, he wants to escalate the tensions to the region. He wants to bring in the U.S., and he wants to bring the NATO in. But definitely, they will receive a response.
Sure.
Iran has shown on multiple cases, according to the Israelis, whenever they have done something wrong, like assassinating Dr. Fakhrizadeh, the Jerusalem Post reported that the father of their aerospace program, Avi Har Even, was killed at the heart of Israel a few months later when they conducted a sabotage attack at Natanz two times. Their main ballistic missile factory offer went into the air and experienced explosion. When they started attacking Iranian ships, they said that their own ships, greater number came under attack. So there are different ways that Iran will definitely provide a response itself and through its allies. Definitely, this is going to happen.
Okay. I'm sorry. We're just fresh out of time.
If it comes directly.
I do apologize. I do apologize for that. Sayyid Mostafa Khoshesh, political analyst. Sorry. We're just fresh out of time. Sayyid Mohammad Morandi, thank you. University professor and political analyst, both from Tehran. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitaly and the team, it's goodbye.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to our latest episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. As you know, last week we started explanation of Surah Nuh, which was revealed in Mecca and has 28 ayahs. It opens with an account of Prophet Noah, hence its title is Nuh. It sheds light on the relentless efforts of this ancient prophet to guide the obstinate disbelievers to the path of monotheism and virtue by warning them of divine punishment before the massive flood that finally drowned them for their sins and idol worship. The disbelievers of his time had transgressed all moral bounds. If they had availed of the centuries-long respite given to them by the all-merciful Creator and repented and reformed themselves, they would have been spared of the terrible punishment. The message of this surah is that pagan superstitions and cults do not add to human knowledge or well-being. They only increase error, evil, corruption, and injustice. Noah is the first of the five great prophets, the other four being Abraham, Moses, Jesus, and the last and greatest of them all, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. He lived the longest time span and is the only prophet whose mission of 950 years is mentioned in the Noble Quran. Ordered by God Almighty, he built the huge ark to rescue a pair of every kind of animals and the small number of people who were on the right path. And thus, he succeeded in the deliverance of the virtuous among mankind and other species of living things from the great flood. Glimpses of Noah's mission are also found in the Surahs A'raf, Yunus, Hud, Anbiya, Mu'minun, Shu'ara, and Ankabut. We continue from where we left you last Friday, and here are ayahs 15 and 16.
أَلَمْ تَرَوْا كَيْفَ خَلَقَ اللَّهُ سَبْعَ سَمَاوَاتٍ طِبَاقًا وَجَعَلَ الْقَمَرَ فِيهِنَّ نُورًا وَجَعَلَ الشَّمْسَ سِرَاجًا.
Have you not seen how Allah has created seven heavens in layers and has made therein the moon for a light and the sun for a lamp? Remember, in our explanation of the previous ayahs of this surah last week, we said Prophet Noah presented logical and meaningful arguments in order to make people understand the depth of their own being by reflecting on the Almighty Creator's infinite bounties, both material and spiritual, so as to ensure the proper progress of sound and healthy societies. The various stages of our life are food for thought and should arouse human conscience to repent and return to the path of the All-Merciful Lord. The ayahs that we recited to you now are part of Prophet Noah's arguments to the obdurate disbelievers, whom he invites to reflect on the numerous signs of the majesty of God all around us and above us. He has created seven heavens in layers for our benefit, even if we are not able to fully observe them. Ayah 16 says, God Almighty has made the moon reflect light for our benefit, while the blazing sun is a brilliant lamp. It is true that billions of celestial bodies, far more brilliant than the suns and moon of our solar system, exist in the seven heavens. But the latter, too, are of significance in our life, since they give light in the day and at night, respectively. From these ayahs, we learn that, number one, the entire creation is far greater and wider than man has been able to perceive and know, which means the scientists shouldn't be proud of their findings and discoveries. Number two, paying attention to the vastness of the heavens and the innumerable celestial bodies moving in their specific orbits is among the ways for proper cognizance of Allah, the Almighty Creator. And number three, the life of the inhabitants of the earth totally depends on the sun and the moon, which are the creation of Allah, the Exalted, and therefore should not be worshipped as deities or regarded as accidental elements of evolution. Let us listen to ayahs 17 and 18 of the same surah.
وَاللَّهُ أَنْبَتَكُمْ مِنَ الْأَرْضِ نَبَاتًا ثُمَّ يُعِيدُكُمْ فِيهَا وَيُخْرِجُكُمْ إِخْرَاجًا.
And Allah made you grow from the earth with a vegetable growth. Then He makes you return to it and He will bring you forth. These ayahs refer to the creation of mankind and the role of the earth in our life. It means, although we are born from the mother's womb, the main source is the ground on which we walk and exist. Since the drop of fluid from which we originate was made from the food that the parents had eaten, in other words, our food is from the soil, either directly or indirectly. Thus, the term growth, as applied here, and its reference to vegetation, indicates that mankind has been created from clay, and all nourishment by which we grow comes from the earth, directly like vegetables, seeds, and fruit, or indirectly like meat. Moreover, there exist many similarities between mankind and vegetation, which are both governed by the laws of nourishment, growth, and reproduction. Ayah 18 is a reference to death and eventual resurrection. We all return to the earth from which we grew, and it is the Almighty Creator who will bring us back to life from the earth on the day of resurrection for the final judgment. In this way, Prophet Noah produces arguments to try to convince the disbelievers on the infinite power of the one and only God, whose majesty can be observed by reflecting on the system of creation. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number one, the earth is among the symbols of Allah's power in creating all creatures from soil. And number two, He who has created us from the earth is able to resurrect us after we have died and our bones decayed and turned into dust. In conclusion of this week's episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, here are ayahs 19 and 20 of Surah Nuh.
وَاللَّهُ جَعَلَ لَكُمُ الْأَرْضَ بِسَاطًا لِتَسْلُكُوا مِنْهَا سُبُلًا فِجَاجًا.
And Allah has made the earth as a vast expanse for you, so that you may travel over its spacious ways. These ayahs mean to say that the earth is not only the source of food for mankind and all other creatures, but it has been made habitable for settlement and proper growth and progress. The earth is neither so hard and tough nor so soft and shaky. It is quite suitable for all creatures existing on it and even under its surface. The temperature on the earth is such that all creatures enjoy their needs. The mountains and valleys have been created in such a way as to make it possible to travel through them. In short, all conditions have been provided for the progress of mankind, the most excellent of creation. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number one, Allah has prepared the earth in such a way that all our needs are fulfilled through its natural environment. And number two, the optimal enjoying of the natural bounties require travels around the earth by availing the excellent conditions provided by Allah.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.